Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here, my guest Scott Craven, who's a recently retired UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He's really not retired. He's got a full... The calendar is full, plumb full, isn't it?
It seems to be. Retirement doesn't seem to be quite as billed, but that's okay. The way I wanted it, so it's fine.
You have some questions for Scott, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or if you've got an identification, maybe you've got a photo of a bird or an animal or something you want us to try and identify, you can post that on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, so you can do that too. And you have been a busy guy, and things are really busy in the outdoors this time of year too.
Well, unusually busy right now because of this weather. I mean, how could it be much nicer? I mean, mid-70s during the day and 40s and 50s at night, and it seems to be going on as far as they're looking into the future. So it's fantastic. If this is our Indian summer, then it's a really nice one. But in any event, in part because of this warm weather, things are sort of backed up. We would have expected a lot of leaves to start coming down pretty quickly so that the grouse hunters would be out and about in northern Wisconsin, but there is still a lot of leaves on the trees. The birds are still very active. The hummingbirds are still around, and that we can preempt a common question. You know, should I take my hummingbird feeders down? And in fact,
no.
You can keep them up. The hummingbirds will know when it's time to go, and they'll go. So you don't need to worry a whole lot about that. Snakes are still out and about. Day before yesterday, I picked up a northern brown snake or a DK snake right in front of the mailbox. So it's a good thing I checked the mail instead of candy. But anyway, and yesterday morning I picked up a red-bellied snake in the road. So these snakes are out right now on their way to Hibernacula, the places where they spend the winter. And they're delaying on this nice warm pavement to warm up a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes a fatal mistake. So keep an eye out for snakes of all types. They're quite active. And a lot of birds are still around. And, of course, hunting season, there's a big opening day coming up this weekend for a lot of different species and a lot of other activities.
This is pheasant this weekend?
Pheasants opens at noon on Saturday, and that's always popular for the state's pheasant hunters. Let's see, the youth deer hunt is this coming weekend. Well, pheasant season's a week from this weekend.
Yeah, it's actually a week away.
Yeah. This weekend, the 8th and 9th, is the youth deer season, youth deer hunt. And then on the 15th and that weekend, sharp-tailed grouse, quail, the pheasant opener at noon, the chronic wasting disease antlerless only hunt, the 4 days, Thursday through Sunday. Lots of stuff going on. Last night, for example, driving home from the office, and don't ask me why I was in the office at 7 o'clock. But anyway, I was driving home just at dusk, and just as I got turned the corner to go home, a coyote ran across the road. I turned the next corner, and there was a big old possum waddling across the road. Then I turned into the driveway, and there's a herd of deer going across the driveway. So there's lots of stuff out and about. Go out and see it.
Marty in Spring Prairie has a question or comment. Let's go to him. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about all the roadkill skunks I'm seeing around in Walworth County here. Do you have any insight you can offer on that?
Well, kind of the same line of reasoning we were just discussing, and that is that just about everybody, in terms of the wildlife resource, is out and about right now. There's food all over the landscape. I was wandering around in the woods in Iowa County yesterday. It's a tremendous nut crop. There are black walnuts everywhere. A good hickory crop, good acorns. It's a good corn crop. There's food everywhere. The weather's nice. And the animals know very well that winter's right around the corner. So everybody's out and about, and the skunks included. And as they're wandering around, skunks are not particularly fleet of foot. And they're not particularly concerned about anything bothering them because of their defensive strategy. But one thing spraying doesn't work well against is a speeding motor vehicle. So as a result, skunks, like possums, are very prone to roadkill. And I think it's just their very active period right now that's making more of them vulnerable.
Yeah. Thanks, Marty, for calling. Bob in Land O'Lakes, we go to you now. Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm a forester. I've been working up in northern Wisconsin for about 30 years. And have been treating some of these same stands along the top part of the state, along Highway B between Land O'Lakes and Presque Isle, if you know that area. for about 25-some years. And, you know, we've been cutting in these woods for all that time and have had real problems trying to get the hardwoods to regenerate because of the deer herd. I mean, we have stands that we cut 25 years ago that has nothing but raspberries growing in them, and the maples are there to just cut back, or they just, you know, prune or browse back every spring.
They look like shrubs.
It looks like, it's like a little bonsai tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now that the wolves have moved in, all of a sudden we have, in these stands that were treated some 20 years ago, seedlings and saplings that are developed, you know, 10 feet, 15 feet above the browse layer in just a couple of years. And it just took all, just finally the deer. And what, you know, moving out of these stands, and what we're seeing, if you look at that, those maps that the DNR has on their website of the where the wolf packs are, mm-hmm. is that they're radio collared. They know very well where they are, and you can see sign of the wolves they're in. We still have plenty of deer, but what happened? What seems to be happening is that deer have moved into these corridor areas between these home territories of the wolves. There's usually about a mile or 2 miles of a corridor between them, and that's where the wolves, I mean, the deer kind of congregate because they're very smart. So it's not so much that I think the wolves are taking a lot of deer, it's just that they're changing the habits of the deer. And, you know, people's concern that the wolves are going to overpopulate the North Woods is unfounded, because they self-regulate because of these home territories they have. So I guess from a forester's perspective, I see the wolves as a very positive thing. There's, like I say, there's still, you can still see lots of deer in the woods. You still see them on the roads. You see them just about everywhere. It's just that they've moved out of a lot of these areas, which is from the forest perspective, a very good thing. I don't know if you have any comments about that, or these are my observations over the years.
All right. Thanks, Bob, for calling.
No,
Scott?
Thanks, Bob. I mean, that's a fairly common comment among the foresters and among some private landowners who have been trying to work on forest regeneration or plantations or other such things, that deer have made that quite a challenge. And the lower deer numbers in northeastern Wisconsin have probably improved. Well, you've obviously seen it improved.
Yeah.
So that has made things a little better. How much of it can be, I'm sure some of it can be attributed to the wolves. But if you look at the other DNR map, or they put out lots of maps, but if you put out the one that shows the current regulations for this upcoming deer season and the relationship of the deer population to their overwinter goal, you'll also notice that there's a band of counties there in northeastern Wisconsin that for the past 3 years have been no doe harvest counties. Because they really took a beating over with winter weather over the last 3 or 4 years. And so there are several, it's very unusual when it comes to wildlife or any natural event that one single thing can be fingered as the answer to what people observe. And in this case, wolves certainly are an issue, and they have changed deer patterns of distribution and perhaps to a certain degree numbers in some areas. But so has recent winter weather. And this year, the regulations have changed dramatically in some of the deer management units to increase the, or to reinstate essentially the antlerless deer harvest, because the herd has bounced back. But concern over forest regeneration has been high on the list of the Governor's Forestry Council for quite a while, and amongst foresters at all levels. So things are better, that's good.
That's good.
However,
that's
and why ever they happened.
Ross in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Ross. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
I'm in Madison, and I'm not a deer hunter, but I like to get outdoors, and I talk with different hunters, and it seems, anecdotally speaking, that you hear stories about how the deer population, there's been a lot of frustration with it, and some, like with people up north, they'll say that the numbers seem to have gone down. But what I'm kind of wondering about is this, this deer czar that's going to come in and do some analysis. And I was wondering if you have any perspective on, like, what, if you know anything about this individual coming from Texas, what he may be able to bring to the table that the DNR and maybe the Conservation Congress here in Wisconsin are unable to sort of do to sort of find out what the problems with our deer herd here is.
Well, very interesting question, Ross. There has been a lot of anxiety in various sectors of the hunting community over deer distribution, deer numbers, deer management for years. But that's nothing new. There's been contentiousness over the numbers of deer and whether does should be killed or not and how many that go all the way back to the 1940s and Aldo Leopold's very, very difficult and contentious arguments that proceeded across the state over the harvest of antlerless deer. So it's nothing new. The deer trustee that's been appointed, Dr. James Kroll from Texas, has been tasked with coming up with a preliminary report by, I think it's early March, and a final report by sometime in June, as essentially an arm's length look at Wisconsin's deer management program and what's good about it, what might not be so good, and where improvements can be made. What Dr. Kroll brings to the table is an outside perspective. Of course, it's important to realize that Texas and Wisconsin are about as different in terms of deer management and deer harvest strategy and access to the public and many other parameters of deer management as you could get. It couldn't be much more different. However, I don't know him personally. I know of him. If he, in fact, is an expert in deer population dynamics, the basics of deer biology don't change all that much from one place to another, although there are even differences in reproductive performance and size and a whole host of other things that are biological or in nature. So it surprised me a little bit that this actually happened. Campaign promises at the whether it's at the mayor's level, the governor's level, the president's level, or any other political level, campaign promises have a way of sometimes coming to fruition and sometimes not. And this is one that I'm sort of, on the one hand, I'm pleased that the governor is honoring his promises in various things and making them happen. On the other hand, Wisconsin's deer program has been audited numerous times over the last few years. And in general, the audits have turned up a little tweaking here and there, but generally have been very supportive of Wisconsin's deer management efforts. Therefore, I'm not altogether certain what yet another audit is going to produce. It was my initial impression that the trustee, or czar, as you use the term, was going to have a much more hands-on kind of active role in overseeing essentially day-to-day activities rather than this notion of a long-term audit. But this is the way it's come down. Only time will tell what comes of it. I hope personally that something good comes of it. Some money's obviously going to be expended. Effort will be expended. People will vent their frustrations. And we'll see what happens. I have no particular crystal ball to tell you what will come of this. But I will say that despite grumbling in some sectors over, there's not many deer here, there's too many over here, I didn't see one, I did see one, I didn't get a big enough one, the reality is that we kill a lot of deer in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And deer hunting, for the most part, is known throughout the country. I mean, this is a mecca for deer hunters and deer hunting. It's still a very powerful tradition and force in the state. It's economically important. The deer herd is still, in many areas, larger than the DNR would like to see it, although, admittedly, there are areas where it's also too low. But that's just the nature of deer. They don't get together and say, hey, we need three more of you guys over in that square mile because there's too many of us here. It doesn't work that way. So we'll see what happens. I don't know what to expect. I can't predict anything, but I hope something good comes of it. And overall, I still have a great deal of faith in the program. And if the public mandate and the resources are there to manage deer, I think we can handle it.
Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question for Scott, I hope you'll join in as we talk wildlife with him. Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to have you come to our Facebook page. Go to The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photograph there or a question or a comment, and we'll get you on the air. Gary in Milwaukee has a question for you, Scott, so let's go there. Hi, Gary. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. All summer long, I sit in the backyard for dinner, lunch, whatever, and enjoy all the goldfinches throughout our area.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeder. All of a sudden, a certain time of year, probably happened within the last 30 days, there's no more males, if you will, or goldfinches around. Do they molt and turn olive drab green with the rest of them, or what happens to them?
Well, there are several things that happen. For one thing, they do molt into winter plumage, and they all kind of look a dull green in coloration, so that's part of it. They didn't go anywhere. They just changed appearance mm-hmm. over time. And then in addition, of course, this time of year is fat city in the environment as far as most birds are concerned, and things like goldfinches that are working over sunflower fields and native prairie seeds and a whole host of other things simply are not that reliant on bird feeders anymore or backyards, and they're simply in different areas. So, if, for example, a month or so ago when the dove hunting season opened, I heard a number of hunters mention how many goldfinches were around those planted sunflower fields that the DNR put in for dove hunting. And it turns out that the goldfinches are actually pretty important. They're the first birds that can kind of cling to the sunflower heads, which the doves cannot. And they actually kind of bust things up a little bit and start knocking seeds loose that go to the ground where the doves can actually forage on them. So they're in different places and they're in different appearance, but there's no particular calamity here involved. Gary, give them a little time, and during the winter they'll be back at your feeders, and next spring they'll look like wild canaries again.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We have, I should mention, by the way, that there's an article on you in the State Journal yesterday, and we put it up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show.
Oh, swell. Thank you so much.
You were outstanding in your field, yes. So to speak.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. Nice photo there. Well, that was fun. We had a question, and again, that's up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, so you want to learn all the insider secrets about Scott. You can go there. We had a Facebook question from Doug. I don't think this is one. I
read that one about the fish. I really don't know what to make of that.
There was a fish that Scott or that Doug was describing, but we can't from the description really have an answer there. Mike posted a link on Facebook and says NPR just did a story that skunks seem to be in the Chicago area. I seem to be smelling them very often in southeast Wisconsin, too. Is this Chicago trend carried over to Wisconsin as well?
Well, the notion that there are more of them in the Chicagoland area, and is that true in southern Wisconsin? It was a fairly benevolent summer for many species. So all these animals tend to fluctuate around what you might consider their normal population, and skunks are one of those things that are kind of fly under the radar. Nobody's out there doing citizen science surveys on skunks. There's no monitoring of them because they're a harvested species,
right,
or anything like that. So basically we rely on anecdotal observations of people seeing large numbers of roadkill or lots of skunks in the backyard. It could very well be a good year for skunks, but we don't know for sure.
Don't know for sure. Esther in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Esther.
Hello. My family saw a spider in Vilas County this summer. It was 4 inches large, and it was lavender. And we're wondering, it can't be native to Wisconsin because we've never seen it before, but is it poisonous? And what is it?
So the 4 inches, does that refer to the body size or the legs and the body?
Including the legs.
Okay.
Well, being a confirmed arachnophobe, who's among all of the Earth's creatures, I'm least fond of spiders than anything else, and many of my friends are aware of that and take advantage of the situation. But in any event, in northern Wisconsin, there are some really big, hairy spiders, especially along the lake shores, that are called wolf spiders, and they can be pretty impressive looking. The lavender coloration, I'm not so sure about that. Sometimes coloration is sort of in the eye of the beholder or has something to do with the angle of the sun or a whole bunch of other stuff. But this is a question maybe best directed to Phil Pelletieri, but my guess is that it's some type of wolf spider, which is not uncommon up there and pretty impressive when you see them. On the other hand, you know, there's always the outside possibility that these things, there are large tarantulas and such things in the pet trade and in captivity. You know, who knows what kinds of weird things might happen.
I'm betting wolf spider.
Okay.
Are tarantulas ever lavender colored, though?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
It's possible. But so lava, kind of a rosy purplish color. Like lilac or something.
Yeah, right.
Hmm. Well, I've seen lots of wolf spiders, and I've never seen one that I would describe as lavender or pinkish
lilac.
Or purplish or
yeah.
lilac or anything else. But I, as I said, I go out of my way to avoid them when I can. So maybe that's a question either
Phil Pelletieri will answer.
Phil Pelletieri will get to it, or maybe someone else has seen something similar. So
yeah, maybe we'll somebody see. Can phone in, too. So stay listening, Esther. We'll see what we can come up with. Phil's on next Wednesday, as a matter of fact, so you could phone next Wednesday, too, if we don't get an answer before then. Let's go to Barbara in Menominee next, Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I really need your advice. I have a young buck who's been around our house for the past 2 years. This year, he had a nice pair of fork horns. He lost one of his horns, but he's a very friendly kind of guy, follows me around the yard, and we can get within 10, 15 feet of him. I've noticed in the last week and a half that he's developed a large, black, almost tumor-like form on the side of his head, and he seems sluggish. Last night I noticed as he was following me around, he was coughing uncontrollably. And I was wondering if I should contact the DNR if he has some sort of disease or is contagious. I really can't do anything about it myself, but I'm just wondering if I should contact the DNR about him.
The short answer is absolutely. The second answer confirms what you've already said, which is that there's very little you can do about it. It's unfortunate when we see wild animals that are in general very healthy and very tough in terms of their resistance to diseases and parasites and things like that, but it does happen. Male deer in particular, there's been a lot of interest in a problem with abscesses and whatnot around the antlers on the head, but there are also some things that cause tumor-like growths on the face and jaws and head. I don't know what this might be specifically, but I do think you should contact the local DNR office and get through to their health team in Madison and describe it. And if you can get, since he's that friendly, if you can get a picture of it, and then
actually,
maybe,
she's in Menominee, Michigan.
Yeah.
Well, okay, then the best thing to do, I don't know what the situation is with the Michigan DNR, but at least in the Wisconsin DNR, they have a health team that operates out of the central office in Madison. And I think with a little Google work, if you go to the DNR webpage in Wisconsin, you can. There's a section on the upper toolbar called Contact Us, and then by topic or individual or whatever, you can get the contact information. And then as I said, if you can get a photograph of it, if the deer is that friendly, get a photograph and email that to the health group, and I think you'll get an answer. And I'm guessing that they have a counterpart in Michigan that can accomplish the same thing.
Okay.
But I think the best way to get it, the best way to get an answer is to get a picture of it so that you're not dealing with the vagaries of descriptions and interpretation, that they can actually take a look at it.
Well, do they still have the bovine tuberculosis that they've been worried about in the upper Wisconsin, Michigan area?
The TB issue has not been a huge issue in Wisconsin. That was a big issue in central Michigan, which was a concern over an area of infection where they implemented the same kinds of herd controls and bans on baiting and feeding and so forth that Wisconsin's been dealing with chronic wasting disease. And I, as far as I know, that's still an issue in Michigan, but not a big issue here in Wisconsin. And I'm not sure whether that, what you describe as symptoms, is typical of TB or not. But nevertheless, given all of the concern over diseases in deer herds around the country right now, if this is indicative of something, I'm sure your local people would like to know about it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good.
Okay.
Thank you, Barb.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Maddie in Oneida, on to you. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to comment that I think there's entirely too many deer out there. And I know that when they did cut back on the herd, many of the hunters whined about it because they actually had to get out and hunt. They couldn't just stand there and wait for a deer to walk by. And anyway, you know, we hit them with our cars. I see it all over the place when I travel. They carry the deer tick and Lyme disease. And I just wish that the state would cut back on the herd. And also, you know, it would be better for the deer because they would have less of that chronic wasting disease. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, and Maddie, that's not an uncommon opinion,
no.
And there's clearly a downside to a large deer herd, whether it's deer vehicle collisions, forest regeneration, ecological impact,
sickness
crop
among
damage,
the herd.
Herd health. There are a whole host of reasons why an unusually or abnormally large deer herd creates problems. And in the defense of the managers here, as we're looking at yet another audit, they've been working pretty hard to get the deer herd down to areas or to levels which would mitigate some of these difficulties.
Yeah.
But in areas where the herd dropped more toward the goals that were established many years ago, there was a hue and cry that all of a sudden, instead of being able to say, hey, folks, you know, this is the new reality. This is maybe what it was like in the 70s or 80s, and this is what it's going to be like in the future. In fact, largely because of political pressures, tools that were used, like this earn-a-buck regulation, that did, in fact, help get deer numbers down. It wasn't popular, that's sure, that's to be true, but nevertheless, it did the job, and now all of a sudden it's gone again. So it is a very... I don't envy the new deer trustee his task, because this notion of you can't please all the people all of the time is certainly true, as true with deer management as it would be with anything else you could think of.
And as long as we're talking about deer, I wanted to mention a caller, Ron. Ron is part of the Conservation Congress in Door County. He wanted to remind folks about Bob Wilging's book, On the Hunt, The History of Deer Hunting in Wisconsin, as a great resource and read. And had Bob on the show not too long ago, and I've read the book, and it is a fabulous book about our Wisconsin deer herd.
It is, and there are a number of others too. And
yeah.
I think anyone who's kind of concerned or perhaps has the perception that, wow, all this controversy is something new, you ought to look back at the history of Wisconsin deer management. And then the old adage, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it, certainly seems to be as true with deer management as with anything else.
Yeah, it's very, very true. Caller from Winnebago County would like to hear your observations about rough grouse population in northwestern Wisconsin, especially relative to the predictions that were made. You know, we were supposed to be in starting the downward swing, and instead we're at high levels.
Well, there's some debate about that right now, and the only thing I deeply regret is that I don't seem to find the time to get up there and answer the question for myself. But as you said, the anticipation back in the spring or last year was that we had started the downhill slide on this 10-year cycle, and that grouse would be less abundant this fall than they were last, which may have been the peak.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that causes great anxiety in the force, and people say, oh, gee, grouse are going to disappear for a few years, which is inevitable. However, then along came the spring grouse drumming surveys, and wow, rumors started to circulate that, you know, so-and-so counted more grouse this year than he has in the last 10 years, and somebody else counts up. And when the numbers came in, the Northwoods were up. It was somewhere around 38, 40, 43%, something. It was very high. And that caused great joy amongst grouse hunters and people in the Northwoods who derive economic gain from the presence of lots of grouse hunters. Well, then along came the brood counts, which are taken obviously later in the year, and those didn't seem to quite support this notion that they were way up as much as the drumming counts did. So the proof will be in the pudding, and that's going to be over the next week or so when the leaves are finally down and grouse hunters are out there over the next couple of weeks in good numbers.
We'll soon find out.
We'll soon find out whether or not they are up, and I'm sure in some areas people are going to find lots of grouse. And there are other areas where, whoa, what's going on here? We thought they were up, but we can't find any. All I can say is that in my driving around the cabin and so forth, I have not seen nearly as many, you know, darting across the road as whatnot as I would have expected. And one of my colleagues who was up in the northwestern part of the state bear hunting last week for 4 days commented that in driving miles and miles of back roads and whatnot, they saw surprisingly few grouse relative to what they expected, given the rhetoric about what was going on. So For anybody who's been out there hunting over the last few days, where the leaves are starting to come down, tell us what you think. I'm really curious personally, but I think there are going to be plenty of grouse to support some great hunting, but I'm not sure that they're as high as we might have hoped earlier.
Is there a bird that tastes better than a grouse? If there is, I'm having a really hard time thinking of it, and maybe it has to do with the amount of effort associated with getting that grouse.
They are certainly tasty, which is one of the reasons they're so popular.
But, good.
We'll see. I hope I have a few to try some recipes on this fall, but so far, nothing to report.
All right. Mary in Minocqua, we'll go to you then. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a problem in that I keep having a red-headed woodpecker come, and it keeps pecking big holes in my cedar posts for my porch. And I have formed a barrier by wrapping with plastic, and then as soon as I take it off, there they come again, and there's another hole. And I don't know what to do about it. I know they're protected. And I don't even know what to do about the hole that's in there, you know, holes that are in there now, but any ideas of how I can get rid of this woodpecker ruining my porch posts?
Well, woodpecker damage on posts and siding and window frames and so forth is a major aggravation and a major economic or damage problem. And it's not an easy one to deal with. I would say that most people first try some type of scare tactics. Things like pinwheels, streamers of Mylar tape. If you go to garden center, you can buy something that looks like a beach ball, but it's called a scare eye balloon. It's got a great big silver eye spot on each side, and these things bouncing in the wind near a post will sometimes deter the birds. Owl decoys, rubber snakes. There are lots of things people try. However, I would say that my years of dealing with woodpecker problems with folks are that the deterrence like that may help for a short period of time, but if it's a particularly persistent bird, eventually you're just going to get frustrated with those scare tactics. If it's home siding, the next step is for people to generally turn to plastic bird netting, which they drape over the siding so the bird can't get at it. In your post situation, I can't see that being particularly useful.
You did. She did put some plastic around.
Yeah, I would say if it's something you can actually armor plate or coat, which you obviously did with your posts with plastic, which would mean the bird couldn't actually get a foothold and therefore peck through it, then I think if you can come up with something, whether it's plastic, metal sheeting, hardware cloth, painted or stained to match the post so that it's not visually offensive to you, then that's probably your long-term solution. Realizing that eventually this is probably one particular bird that's figured out this affinity to your posts, and you've got to develop a tactic that's going to outlive him.
Yeah.
The only other alternative, it is possible in the case of home damage like that, to obtain a permit. You said they're protected, and that's true, but it is possible to obtain a permit through the USDA Wildlife Services Office. There's one in Sun Prairie and there's one in Rhinelander. I think you said you were in Minocqua. So
yeah.
You can call the Rhinelander USDA office, I think it's on Highway K in Rhinelander, and ask about a woodpecker permit. And with the permit in hand, that does allow you to destroy the bird. Now, a lot of people don't want to do that, no matter what the problem is. That's up to you. But
yeah.
It would allow you to do that legally. And the good news with woodpecker problems, which are usually territorial, is that destruction of that offending bird will usually solve the problem. But if you don't want to do that, cover the posts and be done with it.
Yeah.
Well, what I have covered now, it looks so ugly, this black plastic, so I'd like to get away from that. So I would not be opposed to getting rid of the bird.
Well, there are all sorts of other products. So you can buy
a clear plastic.
Sheet plastic, clear fiberglass, clear plexiglass that you might use to make a kind of like fish tank material. There are all sorts of building materials that I think you could find that could be cut to essentially sheath the post and be done with it. It might also be possible that simply painting the post with some type of thick latex paint that would put a smooth enough surface on there that the bird can't get a toehold would also solve the problem.
All right, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. All right, here's a photo. It's got up on our Facebook page. Listener Joseph wonders what kind of cat this is. He saw on a new bike trail in Madison, or is that? Yeah, that's.
Well, it's a bobcat, but it surprised the photo was apparently taken in Madison. Is that what it says?
Well, he said he saw it on a new bike trail in Madison.
Hmm. Well, interesting. I mean, it's a bobcat.
Yeah.
And there are certainly reports of bobcats moving further south and kind of creeping down through the heavily wooded, rugged parts, western parts of the state.
Wow.
Hmm. I don't know what to say. it's a nice picture. It's a bobcat. I mean, it's not somebody's domestic cat.
Scott's taking a very close look at it right now. He's leapt from his chair and
yes, now I'm limping back to my chair, but I mean, it sure looks like a bobcat to me. But my suggestion is that this photograph be emailed up to Adrian Weideman at the DNR office in Park Falls. And Adrian kind of keeps track of large Wisconsin mammals like this moving around the state. I think he'd like to see that one. I don't have any.
He might be listening in. Adrian, if you're listening in, go to our Facebook page.
There's no issue with the picture. We've just had lots of difficulties with pictures, especially of cats and cougars and so forth. You know that, hey, you see the same picture five times and it's attributed to five different places. So I'm just a little bit skeptical. I'm not trying to impugn the sender or picture taker here, but it could happen, and we learned a long time ago in the program to never say never. So yeah, that's a nice bobcat, and if it's here in the Madison area, then I think the folks who keep track of this kind of thing would like to know about it.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Thanks a lot for listening in. Our lines are all filled. Scott, we've got actually a nice story, I think, about the black-footed ferret, and I really wanted to talk about that before we go back to the phones.
Oh, it's kind of a nice story, in part because it's a great success story, but in another sense, it's testimony that the Endangered Species Act and program has worked in many cases. I know that often comes under some criticism, but it's also meaningful to me because this all transpired just a matter of a year after I started on the faculty here at UW-Madison over 30 years ago. But black-footed ferrets, which are kind of a weaselly ferret-like looking animal, but they were long thought to be extinct. They live in prairie dog colonies, feed on prairie dogs. And back in September of 1981, a ranch dog in Wyoming proudly presented his owners with a dead ferret. It was the first one anybody had seen for a long time. Now, fortunately, the vet that looked at it knew what it was, and word got around, and holy cow, they went in, and there were live ferrets there. And at one point, the ferret population at that point was estimated to be 18 individuals, which is a whole lot better than zero,
right,
but not very many. Now the estimate is almost 1,000 in the wild, more in captivity, and they've been restored to prairie dog colonies in Wyoming, South Dakota, Montana, Arizona, Colorado, Utah, Kansas, all over the West. So here we are at essentially the 30-year anniversary of the discovery of this black-footed ferret, and through Herculean efforts at raising these things in captivity, which was not easy,
right,
and then taking them back to these prairie dog colonies and finding people who were still supportive of prairie dog colonies, it's been a neat thing. So while it's still on the endangered species list, the hope is that in maybe another 8 to 10 years, there'll be enough of them to take them off the list entirely. So the system works, and it's a good story.
Mitch in Waukesha has a question or comment for you, so let's go there. Hi, Mitch.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I guess it's still morning. Under my porch, I have something that's dug a tunnel under there. It's about a 2 to 3 inch diameter hole. I blocked it off once, and a new hole appeared about a foot away. I'm wondering what kind of animal would do that. Any idea?
But it's only the diameter of, say, a silver dollar kind of size?
Oh, no, bigger than that, I'd say. Twice the size of a silver dollar.
Hmm. Well, that's good, because if you'd said silver dollar size, I was going to say rat, and nobody likes to think nobody likes to think that there's a Norway rat digging under their deck. But there are a couple of possibilities: chipmunk, ground squirrel, or assorted things that would dig a hole. It sounds too small for a woodchuck. Which woodchuck and rat, mm-hmm, one on the large side, one on the smaller, would be perhaps most likely. But I've got to think that probably dealing with something trying to tunnel up there, getting ready for winter. Ground squirrels should be down underground pretty soon. Chipmunks, the same thing. My suggestion here relates to what we've just been looking at with some pictures that are being sent in. If you can find somebody who's got, and lots of people have them now, have a motion-sensitive camera, a trail camera essentially, just set that thing up on the hole and plug it, and you'll end up fairly quickly with a pretty good picture of whatever it is, and then there'll be no further question about it.
Actually, that's what I was thinking of doing. So.
Well, yeah, give it a try. Send us the picture, and if you can't identify it, we will.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And speaking of pictures, we had another picture posted on our Facebook page. Really got some cool ones now. If you haven't been to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, get there to see the beaver. This beaver swam underwater next to my kayak before heading into the duckweed for a snack. That's very cool, isn't it?
That's a very cool picture, and that is a lot of duckweed. That the beaver's just coated with it. So that's a very neat picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to Lois in DeForest next. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I live a few hundred feet from the O'Hara River, as do many of my other neighbors. A little neighbor boy and his mother, Jackie, found two baby, I think they're snapping turtles, in the road.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to send them off where they're going to help them.
Okay.
They were apparently heading away from the river. What can we do? How can we help them? Take them down near the river, or
I wouldn't take them, too far away from where they were. Generally, when these little guys dig out of their nest burrows, which is about this time of year or a month or so earlier, depending on when they hatch, they seem to know which direction they need to go to get to water. So I'm a little surprised they were headed away from the river, but they may have been confused. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But any type of shallow water area nearby would be just fine, including the river. And if you found two, typically snapping turtles might have 30 to 50 eggs in the nest. There were probably either lots more that had already made it, were still in the nest and about to come out, whatever. There were probably more elsewhere. But if you have two of them, take them to water and let them go, and they'll have a fighting chance then. But the trip is arduous, to be sure, for any nestling turtle.
Absolutely.
Give them a break and help them out. But whether you go to a river or nearby shallow spot, I wouldn't throw them into a, you know, a deep spot near a boat landing or something. But if you can find a spot where there's some emergent vegetation or some shelter and whatnot, where the gulls aren't going to pick them up quickly or a bass isn't going to dine on them, just let them go in the weeds and they'll, chances are they'll be fine.
We have another story. I want to get back to cats, because there's a kind of an interesting story about a Michigan cougar with a radio collar. Well, I don't know if it's really a Michigan cougar, but...
Well, let's see. I've got the press release here. The reality is that this was yet another cougar that seemed to have origins in the Dakotas, and there was no question about this one because it has a radio collar on it.
Yeah.
But, let's see, it was captured twice on trail cameras in northern Wisconsin, and then as it apparently moved around the northern part of our state, it ended up in the UP, and it was seen twice in trail cameras in northern Michigan. And they were able to apparently contact the... South Dakota people who may have put the radio collar on it and got collar frequencies, and the apparently the Michigan biologists have been flying with a radio receiver, tuned to those frequencies to try and pick the cat up. But to date, and this was a matter of a few days ago, they had had no luck finding it from the air. But they've submitted a scat sample to see if they can get genetic information and resolve a bit of the mystery of it. Anyway. Yet another cougar, which, thanks to the prevalence of these trail cameras, has been seen four times, and they've tracked a nice route from Wisconsin into Michigan.
That very cool. Pat in Rio, on to you now. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Yeah, I got a question about Asian beetles and box elders, about how to keep them off my house without harming the environment.
Well, your best bet is to hold that thought until next Wednesday when Phil Pelletieri's on, because I was at Phil's door this morning. He wasn't in to ask him the very same question, because my house, as it is every year in this kind of weather in October, is covered with box elder bugs, and the Asian lady beetles aren't far behind. So I, too, need to find out what the spray is, and Larry may know from previous years, but in any event... Phil's the guy to go to on this, and I need to know as well.
And he'll be on the show on Wednesday of next week. And there is a material that you can spray. And usually it's done in September.
Uh-oh.
But, you know, we're having some unusual weather here. And so you might still be able to. I mean, it's warm enough yet.
Yeah.
It needs to be put on. Otherwise, soon. Those little guys are going to be underneath your siding and into your house for the winter.
Great.
It's Jerry in Minocqua. Hello to you.
Hi. I have a wet boathouse in Minocqua, and I have otters that come up in the night into on the docks on the inside of the boathouse.
And what did they leave on the docks?
parts of fish.
Yes.
And their poop.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
They do it almost every night.
Uh-huh.
And it's a nuisance. I love the otters. I wouldn't want to hurt them in any way, but I'd like to discourage them from having picnics in the interior of our boathouse. Is there, the surface that they use is unpainted wooden planks.
Mm-hmm.
Could I paint them with something that would discourage the otters?
I don't know that that's going to make a great deal of difference. The University Field Station over on Lake Tomahawk has the same problem periodically. The otters are not there regularly, but when they do come through, they hop up on the docks, leave a couple piles of poop, and go about their business, so to speak. It is a bit of a nuisance, and if it happens regularly, as it does in your case, I can see where it would be a bit annoying. But I think you're probably better off, rather than trying to come up with a surface they don't like, if you can somehow, especially as the boating season's coming to an end, figure out some sort of a mechanical barrier along the edges of the boat slip so that they simply can't just hop up onto the dock. Now, whether that's some type of a sheet metal barrier or fencing or whatever you choose to use, I think that's probably the best approach. The other thing it might be to just sit out on this surface. Get yourself a couple of packages of moth flakes, particularly look for naphthalene, and like something product like moth ice, which is naphthalene, and put a couple shallow dishes of this stuff out where they're using it. And generally, mammals of all kinds do not like moth flakes or naphthalene one little bit. And just that odor there, which is easy for you to pick up and take down and won't interfere with your use of the slips, might be enough. Same thing with the scent of ammonia. Again, a shallow dish with an ammonia-soaked rag might be enough to discourage them and convince them to go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Those are good suggestions. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Andrea emailed, lives in Butternut, and seen two young bucks hanging out together in her yard for several months. Surprised to see them together just a few days ago. Is it unusual to see them still together at this time of the year?
Not really. I mean, things are just beginning to break up. As I said, I was out wandering around in Iowa County yesterday, and lots of scrapes and whatnot that were looked like they'd just been opened up the night before, literally. So that kind of activity that causes the bucks to want to be separate is just getting underway. So, no, nothing too unusual about that.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. So happy to have you along as we talk about the wonderful world of wildlife. And our guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today to talk about what's going on out in the outdoors. If you have any questions about wildlife here in Wisconsin, wonder where you might be able to see a particular animal or bird, I hope you'll join in with our questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget our Facebook page as well. We've had some great pictures of photos posted already. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And if you click like when you're there, you'll get regular updates on show topics. We'll be back with Scott Craven right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Every one of our lines is filled. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there as well. Andy in Wanakee has been waiting a long time, Scott, so let's go to Andy. Hi, Andy.
How are you this afternoon?
Great.
Had a question. We live in a retirement community up northern part of Lake Mendota, or right off it, rather. And the last few weeks I've been seeing, I think it's a raptor. I don't think it's a kestrel. I think it's somewhere in between. Awfully streamlined, not real big, long tail, or relatively long tail. Just wonder what that might be.
Well, if it's bigger than a kestrel or sparrowhawk, then there are two likely possibilities. I'm going to say that the most likely is a Cooper's hawk. Mm-hmm. They're not at all uncommon, especially around where you have bird feeders around the.
Yep.
Yeah, especially around bird feeders, as they feed entirely on birds, other birds. Mm-hmm. But a Cooper's hawk would be most likely, and if that seemed too big, if you looked it up in a bird book or online or whatever, then sharp, the one that's in between Cooper's and kestrel would be a sharp-shinned hawk.
Sharp-shinned.
Yeah. But a sharpie's a pretty small bird, too. So my guess would be streamlined, long tail, kind of in the area you're describing, I'd say a Cooper's hawk.
What about, I've noticed we live about a half a mile from Lake Mendota. Is there any amount of osprey in that general area?
Well, there are a few osprey around, but you mean in terms of whether that could be what you're seeing?
Yeah, flying, you know.
So different bird than the one you just described.
Yeah.
No, it's quite possible you might see an osprey flying by. There have been some nesting on a communications tower in South Madison, and they do fly by. They're fairly distinctive in appearance, and there are markings on the underside of the wing that are fairly distinctive. So, sure, that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks very much for calling. And let's go to Bill in Lac des Flambeaux next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I had a neighbor a couple days ago driving my yard. I lived about 8 miles southwest of Flambeaux along Highway 70, and he said he spotted a moose, a bull moose, about 1,000 pounds, and he didn't get the camera up to get any pictures. I was wondering if there's any other people that sighted it or seen it or is out looking for it. So I wonder if there's any comments on that, and I appreciate you getting me on.
Sure.
Well, a couple of comments. First of all, the way you described that, that's perilously close to my cabin in the extreme northeastern corner of Price County, so I'll have to keep my eye open for a bull moose. I'd sure like to see him.
Yeah.
They are seen occasionally up in that countryside, so that's a neat sighting. Personally, I haven't had anybody else report that to me, but it seems like we've had lots of callers from the Minocqua and Lakeland area today. So if anybody else has heard about that moose,
yeah,
let's see where he is. I'd like to see him.
Okay.
Great. I know we had him on a 47 going out of Flambeaux. There was a cow and a couple calves. That was 2 to 3 years ago, and didn't hear any more on that. But
there have been off and on sightings in northeastern Wisconsin for years. So if this big old bull's wandered in there, they're more spectacular to see than a cow. So yep, I'd like to know where he is. I'd like to see him myself.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you for calling. Jamie in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling on behalf of a friend who's living not very happily with a bunch of mice. They're in her garage, in her basement. She's got 3 little kids, and she wants to get rid of the mice, but doesn't like the snap traps, doesn't like the sticky things, doesn't want to have to pay for Orkin. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, those were 3 good suggestions.
Well, you know,
I can see why she doesn't want the mouse trap. She's got little kids that are going
to... Mouse problems are very difficult to deal with, and they're especially difficult to deal with if you kind of tie one hand behind your back procedurally by ruling out a lot of tactics. So the first thing I would say is that despite having little kids around, and I've got a couple young grandkids now, and I was just thinking yesterday as I started to stack up the mouse traps that it was time to get after this before the white-footed mice started moving in droves after this warm weather. But I think it's quite possible to place traps in ways in tamper-proof boxes, behind something leaning up against a wall in the garage, especially if it's white-footed mice, you know, high up on PVC pipes or whatnot in the basement where they're wired on. I think there are ways to put them out that would allow the trapping to proceed without hazard to the kids or minimizing the hazard. Rodenticides, poisons, have their own set of difficulties with them, especially with kids around. But again, those too can be put in tamper-proof bait stations that are lockable or essentially child-proof. So there are ways to use all of these things. And the sticky glue traps I've found to be very effective on white-footed mice, which tend to come in at ground level and then run across the pipes and drains and so forth in the basement. Those are easy to bend around a piece of PVC and just wire in place with a long twist tie or pipe cleaner or whatever, and you get the mice as they travel on these pipes, and that's in areas where the kids simply shouldn't be able
to get at
them.
Yeah.
But the first thing, just to get back to the basics, if this is a year-round problem and the mice are in the house and in other areas, the first thing to do with a mouse problem is to get a hold of one of them, literally, and not alive, but dead, and take a look at the thing and figure out whether it's a house mouse, which is going to be uniform gray or brownish all the way around, including the belly, with tiny beady little eyes and small ears, and no sense of it being bicolored at all. If it's house mice, then that's a bigger problem because they will reproduce in and stay in the house year-round and do a lot of damage with chewing. It's just a bigger problem. And if it's house mice, I recommend going to an exterminator. I realize there'd be some cost involved, but that's the best way to deal with a house mouse infestation. If, on the other hand, you see one or catch one and it's got a nice white belly and bigger eyes and big ears and it's kind of a cute little animal, then those are our native field mice, white-footed mice, deer mice, and the like, and they're coming in to the garage and the basements and all just for winter shelter. And those are dealt with in the ways I described earlier with the traps, the sticky boards, and potentially bait stations or bait packs, whatever the woman is willing to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. Okay?
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Eric in Columbus, we are turning to you now. Hi, Eric.
Yes, how's it going?
Good.
All right, last couple years, actually, when I'm out bull hunting, especially, I noticed that there's an animal right around dusk, and it makes this weird, very eerie sound. Almost sounds like a horse whinny, but quieter. I know it's not raccoons. I've heard them. I've seen them. I'm just wondering what it was.
Sounds, if you don't hear them yourself, are pretty difficult. At dusk and the horse whinny, you know, I would suspect it sounds most likely one of the small owls, like a screech owl or a saw-whet or something like that, that you have at least one sound that sounds something like that. But I think the easiest way for you to sort this out is to either go online if you have access to the internet and...
We've been searching online for a long time.
Yeah, there are a number of different tapes and things available called Sounds of the Night and other similar things. Or go to a website like eBird, just E, the letter E, bird.
And yep, I've been there.
And you have you gone through the small owls and don't hear anything that sounds right?
No, nothing that sounds right.
And
I thought maybe a wood duck that all the areas seem to have water or marsh.
Well, I mean, wood ducks do make kind of a, they have a very distinctive call as they're coming in, and they would come in to roost in wooded pools and ponds just at dusk. So that's another possibility. But I think it's going to take a little more detective work on your part to try and match something up to the sound, because the so far the description could fit a lot of different things. And even some of when Phil's on next week, even some of his late summer evening type insects that are up in the trees, like snowy tree crickets and other things that make a variety of weird calls and are very persistent at it. I mean, that's possible too. Or does it seem to be moving when you hear it?
There seem to be more than one, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah. I mean, if it's kind of going by type thing, that lends some credence to the wood duck theory. If it seems to be sitting in a tree or calling back and forth, that supports the owl theory. I think it's going to take a little more internet detective work to come up with something, or make a tape of it and take it into a nature center or send it to us, and we'll see what we can do.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. John and Nina, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, Scott. How are you today?
Good.
Good. Hey, Scott, we're up on the north of the Willow Flowage up there off of Manhart Road. I don't know if you know that one.
I do.
We're
hunted along that road.
Fantastic. We've got a porcupine problem up there.
Mm-hmm.
Our cabins are faced with that T-111, that kind of plywood type of stuff.
Yeah. They love that stuff.
Yeah.
We can't get them to. They've went through the outhouse.
They'll eat all that.
Oh, they are something. So, what do I do? What can. Do we? I see there's some blood products, or peppers, all kinds. We're trying all kinds.
Hardware cloth is
well,
good.
you know, as Larry just pointed out, one alternative is to armor plate things. if you don't want to reside with something other than T-111, then do they seem to be working on flat surfaces, or is it mostly edges and corners?
What they do is they eat. You know, you get the 12 or the 8-inch, and they eat right in the crevices.
Oh, in the grooves.
In the grooves.
Oh, geez. Well, then armor plating is going to require essentially result in covering the whole thing with sheet metal or hardware cloth. You probably don't want to do that.
Well,
so
yeah.
The and then of course the other strategy is to do what you can to thin out the porcupines by trapping or what have you. They're not that difficult to catch in a big live trap, you know, baited with apples or something like that. But
well, as you probably know, we've been dealing with them for years.
Okay.
And years, so we've got certain ways we take care of them.
Okay, I understand.
But we would prefer to discourage them.
Okay, and then the other thing that you mentioned early on is the litany of different types of treatments you might try on the wood. In the old days when some of the wood preservatives like pentachlorophenol were still available, a good application, I mean, that was really toxic stuff. Nothing would chew on that, but you can't get it anymore.
No.
But there are some other alternatives. I think there's one called Wood Life and so forth. A painting contractor might be able to help you with something that they'll find toxic. But of the various animal repellents, the ones that probably have the most merit is either something where the active ingredient is capsaicin, which is the hot sauce you mentioned.
The hot pepper, you bet.
Yeah, the capsaicin is pretty good. And there's another one, which is a fungicide called Thiram, T-H-I-R-A-M, and garden centers carry that. And that's also a good deterrent for animal chewing. And
come up with. Boy, we're really thinking about taking corrugated metal and just going around the areas where they've pretty much gone through and try to keep, but, you know, they climb as well.
Yeah, they climb very well, but there are various metal treatments that are going to be smooth enough that they, if you use that on the lower, you know, 4 feet or so, they're not particularly agile animals. So if you put some sort of a metal barrier up that would both protect the lower few feet and also prevent them from getting higher up, and then painted or stained it to match the whatever you've got on the T111, it would probably solve the problem and not look all that bad.
I'm guessing what we need to do is discourage anybody from using T111 if they don't want to get eaten away.
Well, it's been around for a long time, but it's very vulnerable to animal problems and most particularly to woodpecker damage.
Yeah. There you go, John. Thank you very much for your call. And let's go to Gloria in Shawano next. Gloria, hi to you.
Hi. We live close to the Wolf River, and we had some neighbors build a house there a couple of years ago. And one day, the carpenter was hearing all day long this very strange squeaking sound, and he looked around, couldn't find it anywhere. The owner came later in the day, and they went out again and looked, and they found a large otter that had been convulsing all day long. And so they called, I believe it was the DNR man came out, and they dispatched the otter and sent it in, and the guy said that the otters will eat the mothballs when they put them as deterrents. And that animal, it was terrible. He suffered terrible all day long. And so I just wanted to caution people that apparently otters eat this stuff, and it's kill them.
Well, that's really weird. I mean, I guess I've, you know, in 30 years of talking about some of these deterrents and all, I've never heard of any kind of a mammal that would go anywhere near that stuff. That it's just that the smell is enough to discourage everything from bats and squirrels in attics to woodchucks under a deck to you name it. What an otter would find attractive about that is beyond me. But that doesn't mean that it still couldn't be used if, in fact, hopefully the gentleman with the boathouse is still listening. If that's a valid concern, and I don't know who told him that the otter would eat it, but nevertheless, assuming that's true, then it could easily be placed in a small box or cage made out of hardware cloth or welded wire or whatever that the otters simply couldn't get at it. However, if they're willing to eat it, obviously the smell of it is not going to discourage them very much either.
Yeah.
So
what he said was that people put it like in their boat houses and, you know, like boats that they're storing for the winter, and the otters get in there, and that's what does it. That's what we were told.
Wow, interesting. Well,
very interesting.
I'll see if I can track down a little more.
Let's look into
that
some more.
I don't have any idea why they'd be interested in that, but if that's the case, then perhaps the ammonia smell may be more useful. But it is pretty standard for people to use those kinds of things in stored boats and closed up boathouses and whatnot. So.
Yep.
Okay, thanks for calling. That's pretty interesting.
And Mike in Crawford County, we are on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Thanks, Larry. I've got a plague of woodchucks.
Oh.
And I bought a farm store had a sale a couple months ago on live traps, and mm-hmm. They had, you get two for the price of one.
That's a good deal.
Squirrel size one, little one, and then the big one, which you could probably be big enough for a raccoon. Anyways, I never used one, and I need to know, since there's abundance of food out there, and it appears this one I catch him, but by the time I get something to shoot it, it's gone. And he's eating white clover and red clover, and I have an accumulation of lettuce, romaine.
Do you have any apples?
I don't.
Well, there's a couple of when you say by the time you get something, so he's not getting out of the trap. You just see him, but you can't get him.
Oh, I haven't even set the trap
yet. All right,
fine.
All right, well, there's a couple of things for the trap. First of all, your window of opportunity is rapidly closing.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to be underground here as soon as it turns cold. And therefore, I'd be tempted to allow winter mortality and other things to play out however they're going to, and just be ready to go in the spring. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the time for them to do damage is pretty limited now before they go down for hibernation. And number two, it's a lot easier to catch them in the spring when they first come out, when the whole world isn't a smorgasbord. As you indicate, I mean, there's food everywhere right now. So your opportunity to get them into a trap, even with the most attractive baits like a sliced apple or some carrot or other things that they'll usually respond to, is pretty limited. But they'll work great in the spring. And once you do decide you're going to start trapping, start to put those baits out as soon as the animals are active and kind of get them conditioned to thinking, wow, this guy's a woodchuck feeder. This is fantastic in terms of sitting the trap there, but using a twist tie to wire the door open so it won't work, and let them get the sense that, hey, there's food here around the trap, in the trap, and so forth. And after 2 or 3 days of that, enable the trap, put the bait in the very back of the trap, and you'll get your woodchuck.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to you talking, so I don't lose you here. I called a farm store. You were wondering what to spray your house with for these lady beetles and box elders, and the name of it was Pest Tab.
Pest Tab. Okay.
For $7.99, you get a pack, 2-pack, and that's enough to make 2 gallons. And you use a Hudson type pump up sprayer.
Yeah.
$14.99, you get a 6-pack. And she says she did her whole house with the 2-pack one.
Okay, Pest Tab. All right.
P E S T and then T A B.
I'm trying to remember what the ingredient is.
I think it's like permethrin or pyrethrin or something.
Yeah, permethrin.
I don't know.
We'll, I think it's a permethrin.
Okay, we'll check it out. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. And Bill in Dane County, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Say, I'm looking for, I want to increase my rabbit population in the woods. And I've done it by building brush piles and that, but they tend to go to pieces in 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. or less. And is there any? Do you have any ideas or any suggestions? I thought about burying some PVC pipe or some of the black pipe and just bury it into the ground and let the end stick out so they can use it for a shelter. What's your thought on that?
Well, that's possible, but of course the risk is that those same shelters might be used by skunks or things that you're
yeah.
perhaps not as happy
yeah.
to have around.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
the brush piles are a fine idea. I think you might just want to start, in terms of building your brush piles, start with a layer of some pretty good heavy stuff, even if you need to bring in some logs or timber that might be 4, 5, 6 inches in diameter, and pile those a layer one way with a space in between and another layer crosswise, or use old pallets and get a really solid base, and then put your brush and old Christmas trees and things on top, and I think you'll find they last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much, Bill. And Scott? Boy, the time flew once again.
Time flies.
Time flies when you're having fun, and you will not be with us on the first Wednesday of next month, but we'll try and work something out for
Before deer season.
Maybe that week before deer season we can do something. Let's try and do that. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, he's sure to be back with us. Wednesdays usually we deal with the out of doors and the environment, so it's always great to have him along, and he will be back. And just to take a look ahead, Patricia McConnell joins us tomorrow to answer your animal behavior questions. That's at 11. And don't forget, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Click like while you're there, and we'll send you daily updates on our programs. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.